journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Friday, October 31st, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Iraq negotiates with the U.S. on getting troops out. Thanks, but no thanks, the Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin, and the GOP faces congressional losses. We'll hear from one progressive Democrat struggling to oust her opponent. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. As the presidential election is commanding most people's political attentions, representatives of President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki continue to negotiate a so-called troop agreement. With a December 31, 2008 expiration date looming for the current UN mandate on the U.S.-led occupation, the Iraqi government has requested a number of amendments to the original text of the bilateral agreement. Among the changes the Iraqis would like to see on the so-called Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA, is the banning of the U.S. from using Iraq as a base for attacking neighboring countries. Changes also include inspections of U.S. arms shipments and the removal of language that would allow for troops to stay behind beyond the agreed-upon date of December 31, 2011. President Bush expressed confidence that the two sides would eventually come to an agreement, although a spokesperson for the U.S. State Department said that, quote, the bar to any revisions is very high. Should there be an agreement on SOFA, it still remains highly unlikely that a skeptical Iraqi parliament would approve it. My guest this morning is Raed Jarar. He is the Iraqi consultant to the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome to Uprising, Raed.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us today. It's interesting to hear President Bush being confident that he can strong-arm Iraq into essentially agreeing with what the U.S. has to say. It really calls into question the concept of Iraqi sovereignty. But first, let me get your comment on the fact that Iraq and the Iraqi parliament is putting up quite a strong resistance, at least on the face of it, to what the U.S. wants. And is that significant in your opinion?
It is pretty significant, and it's amazing to see how the U.S. government and media have been ignoring this nonviolent resistance on behalf of Iraqis for the last few years, because the Iraqi parliament existed all along, but no one asked any questions about what that parliament has been doing. This parliament is the same parliament that has been opposing a new oil law that would privatize Iraq's oil and decentralize the contracting process for the last 3 years. And it's the same parliament that has asked repeatedly for the U.S. to withdraw from Iraq and asked to end the sectarian and divisive policies of the U.S. and the al-Maliki governments of building walls inside Baghdad and other places. So the parliament has been active resisting the Bush administration's plans in Iraq, but they ignored it all along. And now they remembered it now because the opposition to the long-term agreement was backed by Ayatollah al-Sistani. And I think this is the only reason why everyone now remembered the parliament. If al-Sistani gave his blessing to bypass the parliament and the constitution, I think we would have yet again ignored the Iraqi parliament's role. Thankfully, Sistani, who is a religious figure that I don't think should be interfering in politics at all, but thankfully he said that any agreement must follow the constitution in getting a parliamentary ratification, and then now the Bush administration and the al-Maliki government are stuck with that. It's a big problem for them because they can't get a two-thirds majority parliamentary approval of their agreement. And it is a big problem that many observers, including myself, think that they will end up asking for a United Nations renewal instead.
Now, you helped translate, I understand, the latest draft of the agreement from Arabic into English, so you're pretty familiar with the agreement, is that right?
Yeah, actually, one of my contacts in the Iraqi parliament scanned and emailed me the final draft of the agreement, and I translated it to English. There are actually two different original drafts. One in English and one in Arabic. The one that I translated is the Arabic one. And that it's very important to note that the two different drafts are actually different. And this was told to me by more than one source in Iraq and in the U.S., that there are major differences between the Arabic and English origin of the draft. And I think this by itself is controversial enough. You know, imagine the administration is saying something to the English legislators and something else to the Arabic legislators, and both of these agreements are considered legally binding. So it's really confusing and missing.
Why do you think there is that difference? And also in terms of what is happening in the parliament itself, how confusing are matters today? Are most people also agreed in the parliament on the changes that they would like to see, or is there significant dissent?
Well, no. Until now, the changes, the agreement was not discussed in the parliament officially. So what's happened so far is that the Al-Maliki government sent the agreement to the first step for ratification, which is to a small coordination committee called the Political Council for National Security. It has leaders from both the legislative and executive branches. Now, that political council showed Al-Maliki that this agreement will never pass in the parliament, and that's why he's trying to do some last-minute makeup on it before he sends it to the parliament, because their test balloon, the political council, showed them that it will never pass in the parliament. Now, once it's sent to the parliament, there are two steps required for it. The first one is to pass the law required by the Constitution to ratify any international agreements. There is a general law required by Article 61, paragraph 4 of the Iraqi Constitution that requires a two-thirds majority of the parliament to pass a law to manage and organize any ratification of any agreement. That law hasn't passed. Now, after passing that law, the parliament can discuss this agreement, and it needs another two-thirds majority of the parliament to pass it. So many people, including myself, think it's impossible for this to happen within the next few weeks. This seems like it needs a few months or years, looking at the Iraqi parliament's face. They can't do all of these things. In fact, many of the parliamentarians that I have talked to don't remember the last time two-thirds majority of the parliament attended, let alone voted on the same thing, you know?
So Raed, what do you think will happen then if the December 31st date comes and goes and U.S. troops are still there, even though Iraq and the U.S. have not agreed to anything? Does that technically then make the troop presence there even more illegal, let's put it that way?
Well, I mean, the troops level is illegal anyway, I think. Let me quote Obama and say, even if you put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. The U.S. presence in Iraq is viewed very widely as an illegal foreign occupation that must end as soon as possible. And whatever the U.S. tried to put fake umbrellas of international law on it, it is still illegal in the eyes of Iraqis and the international community. Now, after the December 31st, the U.S. And the Iraqi governments will find, I'm sure, other alternatives to legalize their occupation. One of them is might be asking for a renewal of the United Nations mandate. Now, I'm not really worried to find excuses for them to continue their occupation. I think they should take what's happening now as a sign that there is a very huge public resistance that is being expressed through nonviolent means. And the Iraqis don't want the U.S. to be there. They don't want any U.S. soldier to be there. They want the U.S. completely to leave. And if the U.S. was to understand this message, I think it should start planning for a complete withdrawal, rather than planning to keep the troops there. Now, if they, both sides, the al-Maliki and Bush, choose to ignore this nonviolent resistance on behalf of Iraqis, I think this will push more Iraqis to adopt armed resistance and violence as a means. And this is a wrong strategic message that I hope will not be sent to Iraqis. I hope Iraqis will not receive a message that we will never give you your country back unless you are violent. I hope they will get a message that we will consider what the majority of Iraqis want without the need of bombs and explosions.
Raed Jarar is my guest. He's the Iraqi consultant to the American Friends Service Committee. Let's talk about the provisions in the draft, or the way in which the United States is trying to formalize a way to get access to Iraq's oil and gas reserves. How is that, or what part of the document focuses on that? And also, what is, you know, is it possible that the U.S. is going to walk away with some kind of access?
There are two different documents that are we talking about here. One of them, the one that I translated, is called the Status of Forces Agreement, or the Long-Term Military Agreement. This one has just to do with the military situation.
So it doesn't actually look at the oil and gas reserves?
No. Mm-hmm. There is a parallel one that I haven't translated. I'm actually working on it now. The other one is called the Strategic Framework Agreement, and that's a different document, just 8 pages, and it has 11 articles. The one that I translated is actually longer. It's like around 30 pages with 31 articles. Now, the Strategic Framework Agreement actually touches on issues like oil and gas and, quote-unquote, helping Iraq in these fields. And now, from the experience of the last few years, the U.S. Now is trying to push Iraq to rewrite its own oil laws through a contract that was signed between the State Department and a private contractor here in Washington, D.C., called Bearing Point. Now, Bearing Point's contract with the State Department included rewriting Iraqi laws, and one of these laws is the oil and gas law. And the oil and gas law was tailored to open Iraq's oil fields to multinational oil companies. Now, of course, this will continue to happen. The U.S. will continue its attempts. A couple of weeks ago, President Bush issued a signing statement specially just to open the doors for the U.S. government to control Iraq's oil. I mean, imagine how ugly this is.
Now, that was a story missed by the major media.
Yeah, I know, because what happened is that the Congress actually included a provision in the authorization bill, and the provision says that the U.S. Cannot use any of this money in Iraq to exercise control over Iraq's oil. And it just made so much sense that this is the right message to give to the Iraqi people and their representatives. Now, the Bush administration gave a signing statement especially to cancel that provision, to say this exact provision, we are not abided by that provision, and we will do whatever we want regarding Iraq's oil, meaning that the U.S. government can use the money to exercise control over Iraq's oil. I thought that was the perfect timing for this message to be sent to Iraqis, that at the same month that the U.S. administration is trying to force Iraqis to sign this long-term agreement to keep the U.S. troops there, the same administration issues a signing statement allowing governmental money to be used to take control over Iraq's oil. I mean, it just it makes it more clear to understand why is all of this pressure and insisting on behalf of the Bush administration to stay in Iraq.
Finally, Raed, in the last couple of minutes, how hopeful are you that an Obama presidency next year could begin next year to change some of this around in terms of both negotiating a troop agreement that is better for Iraqis as well as an agreement on oil and gas reserves that is more in the favor of Iraqis?
Well, you know, when I talk to like supporters of Obama, they say that he's better than what he actually says. They say, you know, he just says these things to get elected. And, I mean, from what I'm reading from his campaign, with the announcements of him and his campaign, Unfortunately, I don't see a lot of change coming in foreign policy in general, and in Iraq in particular. The Obama campaign until today is still refusing to ask for a complete withdrawal. They are still planning to leave permanent bases, or what they call residual force in Iraq, for the same exceptions that the Bush administration and McCain wanted to leave. So I feel a little bit frustrated that there aren't new plans out there. But I hope that what Obama supporters tell me is true. I hope he's lying to us until he gets to the office, and then he will show us his real good face. But from what I can see until now, I don't have a lot of hope of a change in foreign policy, a lot of hope in changes on Iraq. But let's wait and see.
Well, Raed Jarar, as always, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Raed Jarar is Iraqi consultant to the American Friends Service Committee. And by the way, you can read his blog at raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com. That's R-A-E-D in the middle.blogspot.com. And by the way, for the rest of the hour, we will be keeping our instant listener feedback feature on Uprising's website open and available for you to join in our conversations. You are listening to Uprising. The website is kpfk.org/uprising. And in the right-hand column, you can click here to join the conversation now, fill out a form to post a comment or question. For our next guest, who is the author of Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin. And in the end of the hour, we will talk to a progressive Democrat who is attempting to oust her Republican incumbent opponent from Ventura District. We'll also hear today's Black Agenda report. But first, the subversive historian.
KPFK would like to thank some of our generous food donors who donated this recent fund drive. City Walk on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City. Good Neighbor, our neighbor on Cahuenga Boulevard West in Studio City. Vegan Plate on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City. Oh Happy Days Natural Food Store on North Lake Avenue in Altadena. Shamshiri Restaurant on Westwood Boulevard in West LA. H2 Ohm, Water with Intention. Mao's Kitchen at 7317 Melrose Avenue, Los Angeles Friends Meeting in South Central, and many others. Show support and make sure when you visit, thank them for donating to your favorite station, KPFK.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Exactly 145 years ago, on this day in people's history, the New Zealand land wars were reignited. On October 31st, 1863, British military forces under the command of General Duncan Cameron led an invasion into Waikato. In what became the largest in a series of conflicts that framed the land wars, the invasion stemmed from the colonial government's desire to confiscate the fertile lands of the indigenous population. The King Movement, comprising of a federation of Maori tribes, resisted against the incursions and defended their right to land. Devastating confiscations did indeed take place immediately after the British claimed a relative victory, confirming one of the main motivations for the invasion in the first place. This Halloween, there are sure to be bag snatchers taking candy from kids, but 145 years ago, on All Hallows Eve, the British took more than some Snicker bars. They took millions of acres of indigenous land. For Uprising, this is your true professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
With John McCain holding steady in the polls at 7 to 10 percentage points behind Barack Obama nationwide, theories abound as to why his candidacy has trailed so far behind the Democrat. Welcome back to Uprising. We now turn to Sue Katz. Aside from the obvious reasons such as the failing economy and popular disillusionment with the GOP, McCain's choice of Sarah Palin as vice president may have had something to do with where he is in the polls. A Washington Post ABC poll earlier in the month showed that 60% of voters feel she is too inexperienced and less than half think she has a grasp of complex issues. 32% of registered voters said her selection made them less likely to support John McCain for president, up from 19% the month before. But those numbers have not deterred Sarah Palin. She has continued to campaign and attack Obama's policies as socialist, saying that his presidency would make the U.S. vulnerable to foreign enemies. Palin has faced a number of controversies since coming into the national spotlight, from excessive clothing bills to the Troopergate scandal, and now rumors of a growing rift between McCain and her advisors. Media reports abound of Palin going rogue and leaving McCain in the dust. She apparently sees a future for herself in the party. Prepare for a Palin presidency bid in 2012. Sue Katz is a teacher, journalist, and creator of the blog Consenting Adult and the author of Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin, just published. Welcome to Uprising, Sue.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
So Sarah Palin is a very interesting figure. She certainly has made this election very, very interesting. I want to first begin by talking about the issue of executive experience, which was raised quite a bit about Barack Obama when he began running. But Sarah Palin, of course, has had a leadership position as mayor of Wasilla and, of course, governor of Alaska, but she was also a leader in the PTA. Let's talk a little bit about how the Republicans have tried to justify her executive experience.
Well, we could definitely talk about the PTA. I mean, I think she pushed that at the beginning a bit more than she pushed it after, of course, her acceptance speech, in which she made such mocking, snide comments about Obama's experience as a community organizer, which she continued to do throughout her stump speech for the longest time, certainly for the first few weeks. Somehow, mysteriously, getting a rise of boos every time she said community organizer.
Hmm.
So I don't know how much she's counting on her PTA experience, which apparently, according to the national head, to the state head of Alaskan PTA, was totally localized in a totally kind of school-based local activism. So I don't think she got too much political experience out of it.
Let's talk about her role as mayor in Wasilla. Now, Wasilla is a town that I don't think too many people outside of Alaska had ever heard of till Sarah Palin came on the scene. I understand when she was mayor, it was 5,000-6,000 strong. And she was around, I believe, for about a year or two before she became governor of Alaska. How did her role as mayor of Wasilla shape the kind of leader she was going to become?
I think there are two answers to that. Number one, how'd she become mayor? And number two, what did she do while she was in there? Because she ran, you're exactly right. Wasilla was a very small, about 5,000 people at the time that she was running. The kinds of campaign issues that used to tear apart Wasilla were things like, should we have a traffic light? And when she came in, she just upped the ante. She made it all about abortion and about guns. And, in fact, she had the support of national organizations. She brought all this material, buttons and pins and leaflets and whatnot from national anti-abortion organizations. And she produced herself a leaflet, a campaign leaflet, about the incumbent, who was a longtime incumbent, an old friend of Palin's. I mean, everybody knew everybody, certainly in the political world in Wasilla, such a small place. And she said, elect me, I'll be your first Christian mayor. This guy's name is Joel Stein.
Mm.
The implication for a lot of people was, oh, he must be Jewish. But in fact, he's a Protestant. And he says, he's a very sort of generous, sweet guy. I've seen him interviewed. And he said, oh, she just meant because she's a fundamentalist and born again and saved and all of that, she meant that kind of Christian. So that's how she sort of got in on this changing the whole agenda of what the mayor of Wasilla would talk about or campaign on. And once she got in, I think probably the most stunning thing that happened during her watch was that the rape kit scandal. And I don't know if you've discussed that on your show in the past or not.
No, we haven't actually, and it's actually a very, very important point. It's certainly something that I've kept in touch with in terms of when she first appeared on the scene, and it didn't make much of a dent in the major media, and it's pretty stunning. Can you tell us about what her position on rape kits was and what rape victims had to do?
It is, as you say, totally stunning, perfect word for it, because what she did during her time as mayor, and it was never done before, and it was certainly never done after because it was made illegal, was that she and her police chief charged rape victims for their forensic evidence rape kits.
So
it would be
for
like if you had a burglary in your house and they came over to take fingerprints, you'd be getting a bill in the mail for them having taken the fingerprints. But this is no small thing. This is $300 to $1,200, depending on what kind of tests were run. And, you know, eventually it was outlawed by state legislation. And the governor hastened to push that legislation through because of the Violence Against Women Act, which is federal act that provides resources to states to deal with violence against women, but one of the conditions is that women are not charged for their rape kit, because apparently there were like four places in the country where this happened. It was, you know, it's not like a widespread, but it's such a shocking thing. But what I found, what shocked me more than anything else, as I did my research about this, I found out, and I hadn't known it, that America has the highest rate of rape of any country that keeps those stats, and that of the 50 states, Alaska has the highest rate. So we're talking like the rape capital of the world.
Mm.
And this is a situation in which you would want to be throwing money at the situation, looking for the reasons, trying to analyze what's causing this epidemic, and then looking for solutions.
My guest is Sue Katz. We're talking about Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin. It's her brand new book, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so online at kpfk.org/uprising. That's kpfk.org/uprising, and you can post a comment or question for Sue, as well as my next guest, Marta Jorgensen, who is running for Congress, and we'll be talking to her in about 10 minutes or so. Again, that's kpfk.org/uprising. Click on the link in the right-hand column that says click here to join the conversation now, and you can post it in just a minute or less. Sue, she was mayor of Wasilla. How did she get to be governor of Alaska? I mean, forget the fact that she's the vice presidential candidate for the Republican Party. How did this woman get to be governor of a state?
Well, in 2002, she kind of rebranded herself. She left official membership in her Pentecostal church, you know, the Wasilla Assembly of God, which is, you know, in itself an incredible story. But she rebranded herself, and in 2002 she ran for lieutenant governor. That was her first sort of statewide run. She lost that, but she was given kind of a cushy job dealing with oil and energy and whatnot, and then she ran again. Part of, you know, how her career has progressed is because she is very, very clear about her agenda. And this is what helped her become governor, and this is what made her the vice presidential candidate, is that she is very connected to the religious right, both in Washington and across the country. She's very supported by them. She's very encouraged by them. They have been involved. This whole idea that she's just a simple little hockey mom who happens to just be, you know, wear expensive clothes very well. You know, this is not the case. She has been nurtured from the beginning of her career. One of her biggest cheerleaders is Franklin Graham, the son of Billy Graham, far to the right of Billy Graham, very, very wealthy, very powerful. He was the keynote speaker at both of her governor's breakfasts in Alaska. And these are the people that are promoting her. They promote her not because she cares about the crisis in the Congo or she's aware that the Americans are sort of freely bombing around the Middle East, but because she is committed to the fundamentalist agenda, in particular with a really rabid anti-abortion view. And she walks the walk, talks the talk. She does mean it. She does feel it. I don't think she's a hypocrite in any sense of the word. I think she's disinterested in many things, like international relations, like economic policy, and very, very committed to her fundamentalist agenda.
Hmm. Let's talk, Sue, about how American women have responded to Palin's candidacy, and also how Alaskan women have responded to her candidacy, to their governor being shunned in the nation's spotlight.
Well, I mean, I think I would have, I wrote this book in 28 days and nights, I've just really never, I just dumped my life and wrote this book, and I think I would have, shriveled up and died, except that women were so witty in their response to Sarah Palin. She's such a shocking choice. Initially, there was a lot of talk that she was brought in to mop up the disgruntled Hillary Clinton supporters, and that she was sort of a substitute.
That was my guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she was a substitute before people actually understood that she was very bedded into the religious right and the fundamentalist political community. So initially that was the thing, and people said very few women were fooled by that. There was a little bit of a bump, but she had a general bump. And she has never gotten ahead with women. In fact, Obama's 18 points ahead with women. But some people said some very... I think the funniest thing was Gloria Steinem said in a very witty essay about how, just the fact that she shares an anatomy with us does not mean that we're going to support her. She said to vote... Steinem was a big Clinton supporter, so people were looking to see what she would say. And she said to vote in protest for McCain Palin would be like saying, somebody stole my shoes, so I'll amputate my leg.
And also very briefly, Alaska women demonstrated pretty strongly against Palin as vice president, which was an amazing story.
This was the same day that Sarah Palin came back to Alaska. This was September 13th. And they had a welcome home, after she had accepted the nomination and campaigned a bit with McCain. She came back to Alaska in the morning. Sort of the powers that be had a big welcome home Sarah Palin rally, and some women sitting around a coffee table a few days before said, look, we can't give people around the nation, around the country, the impression that all Alaskan women support her. So they just did a little simple email thing that went viral, calling for a demonstration that they called, very literally, Alaskan Women Reject Sarah Palin Rally.
Quite simple, yep.
And they attracted, her rally in the morning, the official rally, attracted, according to authorities, between 1,300 and 1,500 people, which is a huge crowd in Alaska. Their spontaneous, instant, tell-your-girlfriends rally attracted between 1,500 and 1,700. It was the biggest protest rally in the history of Alaska by far.
My guest is Sue Katz. We're talking about her book, Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin. Sue, we have a couple of questions from listeners that have been posted on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. One from Carlos C. Posting is... the Palin future after a McCain loss. He asks, what kind of future do you see for Palin should McCain lose the election? I hear there's possibilities of her having a TV show, which I hope will not happen, but this is America and anything's possible.
It's very, very interesting that he asked that question, because I blog Sarah Palin just about every day. I'm a blogger. That's like the sort of center of my life and the center of my writing life. And just about an hour ago, I uploaded a blog saying that was called Sarah Palin, the Happiest Republican in America. And I think Sarah Palin will, has a huge future in front of her. I think the only political bloc left in a Republican Party that's in complete disarray otherwise, the only disciplined, unified, definite bloc, is the religious right, and she's their girl. And I think they're thinking about her definitely for 2012. She confirmed that yesterday. I have a link to an interview. She blew Wolf Blitzer's mind by actually talking about, oh, no, I'm not stopping here. That would be the white flag of surrender. And I think she has a huge future. Now, the whole thing about the whole Hollywood and this and that, there are restrictions on her as governor, and she can't take outside money and stuff. So although the entertainment industry would love to get a bounce, you know, off of Sarah Palin, I'm not sure that you know, she would have to, like, stop being governor in order to do that.
Right. Well, so your book is going to be quite relevant for a few more years yet. Sue Katz, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sue Katz is the author of Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin, and she's also a teacher and a journalist and creator of the blog Consenting Adult, which we link to from our site, kpfk.org. And finally, Donna from Los Angeles posts that right-wing men are infatuated with Sarah Palin, especially Bill Kristol. She charmed them with visits to the Alaska Capitol, and it's very obvious the men are infatuated. Don't be surprised if she dumps the first dude for a powerful Republican. Thanks for that post, Donna. And you can also, others can join the conversation at kpfk.org/uprising. And again, we've been speaking with Sue Katz about Thanks But No Thanks, The Voter's Guide to Sarah Palin, just published new book. You are listening to Uprising, and after the Black Agenda Report, we'll speak with Marta Jorgensen running for Congress. Glenn Ford is a writer and radio commentator and the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. This week's commentary is about the post-election struggle to come.
The election is now upon us. Barring massive theft, and only a fool thinks the Republicans will not steal as massively as they possibly can, it appears Barack Obama will be the next president of the United States. There is something that is much more certain than Obama's election, and that is that the current economic crisis will deepen, punctuated with increasingly frequent upheavals as the capitalist system convulses in the throes of insurmountable contradictions. And then there is another certainty, that Barack Obama will respond to these convulsions as his corporate friends and backers demand. He will try to do something about rebuilding U.S. infrastructure, but not necessarily in ways that benefit the inner cities, and certainly not in ways that clash with corporate plans for urban America, plans that reserve little space for populations that presently live there. And whatever Barack Obama spends on people's needs will take a back seat to propping up the corporate sector and feeding the all-devouring military-industrial complex. We know this is true because Obama has already shown it to be so. The bailout of Wall Street, which he embraced instantaneously, is but the first of many demands that will be made on the national treasury. All of Obama's economic advisors, the ones that count, are steeped in the corporate culture, organized theft. They serve government in order to serve their class. Obama picked them, so there is no reason to doubt that he will follow their advice, which means every economic measure they undertake will be geared to corporate health, not popular welfare. They will build barricades to preserve what is left of the corporate order, but it will never be enough to withstand the shocks that are in store, and the people will wind up with little to nothing. What the bankers don't get, the military will. Obama has not only committed to maintaining the current structures of the U.S. Armed Forces, but to expanding the boots on the ground by 92,000 soldiers and Marines. These troops will have to be sent somewhere, requiring new overseas facilities, a whole new generation of equipment, and increases in salaries and benefits to keep the recruits coming. But most of all, the new administration will face tremendous pressures to deploy forces to project military power where U.S. economic power is no longer decisive. And that will mean a lot of foreign destinations in the coming months and years. Before the crisis of finance capital hit, the military was already strangling the nation's ability to meet human needs. Only a fundamental break with militarism can halt this military spiral into bankruptcy and war. but nothing in Barack Obama's background offers any evidence he is capable of making that break. No, the American people are not doomed, because they will fight back, as people always do. But that bleak struggle will take place under very different direction than today's so-called black and progressive leadership, most of whom are hopelessly wedded to Obama. They claim they'll take up the people's cause after the election, but nobody should believe them. Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente of the Green Party will be there, part of the new leadership, to replace those who capitulated to Obama. Elections come and go. Struggle is a constant. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Visit www.blackagendareport.com for more information. While polls indicate a lead for Democratic candidate Barack Obama going into the presidential election, they are also suggesting that his party stands poised to make significant gains in Congress, seeking to capitalize on gains made in the 2006 congressional elections. The Democrats are hoping to add as many as 30 seats in the House and as many as 9 seats in the Senate. A 60-seat majority within the Senate would be sufficient to break Republican filibusters. Central to this possible realignment in Washington is the fact that just as in the Obama campaign, Democratic candidates are posing challenges in traditional GOP strongholds. One such stronghold is Ventura County here in California, where a retired nurse and one-time ESL teacher is challenging a longtime Republican incumbent for his seat in Congress. My guest is Marta Jorgensen. She is running against Elton Galigli. Welcome to Uprising, Marta.
Hello there.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us today. Let's talk a little bit about your opponent. He's been in this position for a very long time. It was on the verge of retirement, but then decided to stay. And he is expecting to, and polls are suggesting that he will continue his tenure into the next year. What is your position, or what is your platform, and how is it different from what Elton Galigli is offering?
Well, Elton Galigli has been a rubber stamper for the Bush administration and the Republican Party for many, many years. Obviously, that makes him totally different than me. I am running on a platform that I call the e-revolution, building a new energy, economic, environmental, educational future for our country and our planet. It's basically taking energy, the economy, you know, our environmental issues, and trying to turn it into something that is easy to comprehend by the general public. And it is totally different than Galigli, who's believing in offshore drilling, and he wants to drill in Anwar, and he wants to drill in all the national parks because he feels that being energy independent is just drilling in your country, which, really, to me, energy independence is getting off of the fossil fuel culture and getting into alternative sources, solar and tidal power, geothermal and biofuels. So that's a big difference right there.
Now, basically, would you say that your opponent is sort of a standard Bush-like Republican?
Oh, yeah. He's very, and the thing with him is that he really doesn't try to get a lot of attention to himself. And for all the years that he's been in, he's pretty much, I would say, just played it safe. As long as he plays along the party line, that nobody gives him a hard time, he can just keep going. And I know he's been on a lot of committees. I know he's been on, you know, the committees that really have a lot of say in our policies. But what I hear from my friends in Washington, D.C., who are on those committees, that they don't really like him. They don't think that he really does anything. They call him do-nothing Galigli.
Hmm. Now, in terms of so we just talked about your differences on energy policy, but also what about things like immigration? What about things like healthcare and the Iraq War? Mm-hmm. Your opponent, Elton Gallagher, has a long history in terms of his experience serving on various committees,
right,
et cetera. His record on these issues is pretty well known.
Oh yeah, it goes forever. It goes for many, many years. Now, on immigration, he's been pushing the wall down on the border. And he basically feels that they should make it as hard for people who are in this country working, the undocumented workers, to never really get their applications finalized, and to discourage them enough that they will just go home. He just wants the immigrants who come here to basically give up and go home. And his committees have made our fees for the immigration applications to be really high. He's made it impossible for them to even complete their applications. And some of these people who are here trying to get in are members of other people's families who are here legally. And they can't join their families, you know, legally, so they end up going home. Mm. That's his philosophy with that. I don't feel that way. I think our immigrants are important to us. They come here. They provide a great service. They contribute to our economy. I think that we need to make it possible for people to come into the country from the border or from the other side, go through some kind of program where they can apply to come in as guest workers or come in and work and then go home if they want to. But this.
What about a path to citizenship?
Yeah, I believe in that. Mm-hmm. I do. I believe in a pathway to citizenship, I think. And I think that if children have lived here for several years, they've gone to school and their families have stayed out of trouble and they've paid taxes, that these children should be able to go to college, and we ought to be able to make it possible for them to improve their lives. I am more sympathetic to people who come here because they're trying to just make a better life for themselves.
My guest is Marta Jorgensen. She's a first-time Democratic candidate who is challenging Republican incumbent Elton Gallagher for the 24th Congressional District here in California, which includes most of Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. And she's a progressive Democrat running against a conservative Republican who's had his seat for a very long time. And it's an interesting snapshot of what's happening around the country. Marta, what sort of gains have you made? I mean, your candidacy is not, it's somewhat of a surprise for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You made it past the primary in June, and have you made significant gains in terms of your popularity in the counties?
Yeah, I have. Now,
what are the numbers?
At a very grassroots level, I've made a lot of gains.
Are you aware of any of the poll numbers?
Yeah, well, what's happened is that we've done this massive voter registration in the 24th district, and what we've done is we've narrowed significantly the space between the Democrats and the Republicans to the point where I think I'm anywhere between I think it's like up to 3 to 4 points now behind him, and you know, as far as how many Democrats are registered to vote. It has always been a mainly Republican area, but it's narrowing significantly, and our decline to states have grown, I think it's like 18% now.
And do you think that the same phenomenon that has that you have seen in terms of a surge for support for a Democratic candidate like yourself is what's happening around the country, where Democrats are becoming, essentially it's looking like between now and Tuesday, their position in Congress is going to be cemented in terms of a pretty strong majority?
I certainly hope so. I do think there's a trend for that, and I certainly hope it happens.
And in terms of what you would do if you are elected to Congress, in terms of how you would see your candidacy, you're a first-time candidate, so you actually don't have much experience politically in the electoral political arena. Do you think you're prepared?
I have been putting together a very qualified staff of very experienced people. And this is, I'm going to be doing a lot of training. And I don't think I'm alone there. I think there's a lot of first-time congressional candidates that might win. And I think it'll be great. Only we won't be going in there with jaded eyes, that's for sure. I think there's nothing wrong with being a novice.
Certainly for Congress, that's the stakes aren't as high as they are for president, for sure.
Yeah.
Marta Jorgensen, let's also talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the future of the Democratic Party and in terms of the future of politics here in the United States. Where do you see, how do you sort of see this moment that we're in where Barack Obama is looking likely to be the president, where the Democratic Party is looking likely to have a lot of power, and where people are struggling with the economy and turning to the Democratic Party and away from the Republican Party after 8 years of it being in power? Do you see this as a really important opportunity for the Democratic Party to prove itself? And if so, is it up to the task?
Yes, I do. I think it is their opportunity, and I sure hope they are up to the task. And that means that we're going to have to get rid of a lot of political baggage. We basically have to give our government back to the public to run, and that's just that includes the Republicans and the Democrats, who are the political insiders who really think that they are the be all end all for policy. The American public is very smart, and I encourage them to be more involved in the day to day process, which is what I've done myself.
And Marta, give our listeners information about your website and also what you think they should do, particularly listeners who live in Ventura and San Diego counties in the 24th Congressional District. If they want to see your candidacy winning over your opponents, what do you suggest they do?
My website is www.jorgensenforcongress.com.
And can you spell that?
Yeah, it's J-O-R-G-E-N. S-E-N, and then 4-F-O-R-Congress.com.
Are you still looking for volunteers, et cetera?
Oh, yeah, we're doing, we're trying to get the vote out. This is a numbers game right now. Win or lose, this is a numbers game. We have to get as many people out to vote as possible. So we need a lot of volunteers to do that. Especially Tuesday and Monday. It's really important that people understand that where I live, there is the Gallegly, which is the congressional district, and then the two state districts and assembly districts that are Republican, the Stricklands, Audra Strickland and Tony Strickland. We're working to get them out. And I work in tandem with Hannibeth Jackson and Fariel Masri. We do a coordinated campaign with Obama, where we go and our mailers and our phone banking and our pitches all include the entire ticket.
So listeners can find out more about all of that on your website. JorgensenForCongress.com. Well, Marta Jorgensen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. That's been great. And I want to say hi to everybody in L.A. I used to live in L.A. myself, and wish I was there sometimes.
Well, thanks again, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Uprising, and I just want to let listeners know that on Monday we're going to have an entire program devoted to the 12 propositions on the ballot. That's on Monday's program. It's going to be our special Uprising guide to the ballot. And also on Tuesday, of course, we'll have a very special program, election-related program. Wednesday, we're going to have a special two-hour report back after the elections from 7 to 9 a.m. That is Wednesday morning. happening the day after the election, so definitely tune in for that. And also, by the way, yesterday you heard Robert Jensen on our program talking about the screening of his film, The Price of Pleasure. We weren't sure if that screening was actually happening. It turns out it is happening at the Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena tomorrow at 7 p.m. So if you're interested, definitely check it out tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the Fuller Theological Seminary. You are listening to Uprising, and that does it for today's program. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Mark Twain once said, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes." That's Mark Twain, and that's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. To go on a step of